Eric, you know, where the Torah goes into the listing of the animals and the bird, the fish and the bird, you know, the forbidden ones and the permitted ones. You know, the section which deals with forbidden foods. So, if you take a look, let's go through these psukim. The first thing the Torah talks about is the animals, the ones that are permitted and prohibited. So, of course, we all know that the distinguishing characteristic for the animal is that it has to have split hooves and chew the cud. So, if you take a look at the way the Torah describes it, there's something very interesting. This is Vayidaber Hashem El Moshe V'Yamar Lamer Aleihem. So God spoke to Moshe and Aaron. Dabru El Bnei Yisrael Lamer Zot Achai Eshet Tochu Mikol Behema Shel Aret. So these are the animals that you may eat. Koma Fresas Parsos V'Shosah Eshet Afrosos. That's one thing. The first thing is Mafretas Parsa. That means the splitting of the hooves, and it has to be completely split, not partially split. Malas Gera Babahema, Osa Tochelu. The second one is Malas Gera, which means that it's to chew the cud. That is to say that it has two stomachs, and it regurgitates and chews it a second time. Okay? So now we know that basically the Torah could really stop at this point, because now you know how to differentiate what makes an animal kosher and what makes it not kosher. It has to have both of these simanim. I think we could conclude, of course, any animal that's lacking in both simanim, we would conclude is trade. But if an animal possessed one simanim and didn't have the other one, I think we'd also come to that conclusion. Nevertheless, the Torah proceeds. Achaz de tohu. Mimale Hagera, Achazel Lo Tochu. Then it says, but this, you shall not eat Mimale Hagera, Umafrite Aparta. So then it goes on to tell us specifically that we may not eat these, which are from the Mimale Hagera and Mafrite Aparta, which means it's telling us that there's another category of animals that do possess one of these. But they don't possess both of them. So therefore you can't eat it. And if it goes specifically, it's a gomo, himale geirahu, the camel, which is male geira, uparsai neno mafra, tamehu lachem. So now it's going to enumerate, there are four in this category, four in the category of animals that have one but not the other. Three of them are male geira, but don't have split hooves. And one of them has split hooves, but it's not male geira. So then it says, Be'et HaShachan, Ki male geira hu, Uparta lo yafrit, Tamei ulachet. Then it says, Be'et HaRnevet. I think Arnevet is some type of in the rabbit family, a hare, something like that. Ki male geira hi, Uparta lo afrita, Tamei ulachet. So now you have those three. Be'et HaChazir. And then it mentions the chazer, the pig, kimafis parsahu. This, v'shosah shesah parsah. So this one has completely split hooves. V'ugera l'igar, but it doesn't chew the cud. Tamei ulochem. No, it's tamei. Then it says, v'sarm lo tochelu, v'nivlochem lo tigar, and so forth. So, now when you read this, what is the question that should come to your mind?
Yeah, if you have the general, the split hooves, and the, what's the other one?
Yeah.
The cud, then why is it going to all the animals, or some of the animals, I don't know if it's going to all the animals, or what's not allowed. You just said what you need.
Right, that's the first question. The question is, what is, once the Torah tells you the principles, then so what do I have to go into the particulars now? And why would I, it's enumerating all of the animals that belong to this category. First of all, the very need for the particulars is a problem. There's no need for them because you know the rule. But then, not only that, but it mentions everyone. If you've mentioned one, you want to give an example, so you give one example. But as I said, even that example is not necessary. But then it continues to go through the entire category. So that's a very good question. What's the reason for that? Is there any other question, though? Let's assume that, okay, for whatever the case, this had to be done. Is there any other, just in the way the Torah chooses to describe these, the way it deals with these categories, let's assuming we would understand why it would bring it in, but is there any problem in the way it makes the point?
It seems that I wouldn't have to single each one out differently. The first three are exactly the same. You could have put them together.
No, we've already asked that question. We've asked that question. You're right. But we've asked it in a general way, and you wanted to get constricted and say it's exactly the same point being made over again with the first three. True. But we've made that fine. But let's assume that there was a reason. We'll find out what the reason is. But let's assume we understood why the Torah had to mention these cases. In the very mentioning of it, in the manner of mentioning, is there an issue? Actually, this is the point that really I'm going to be focusing on. So I saw a pshat in the Kli Yakar, which may be slightly different than the way we usually approach it. It may be more of a drush kind of a thing, but I think it's interesting. It makes a very good point. So I want to bring it to your attention anyway. And that's the question, and I think I may have had this question over the years, like not fully focusing on it. But sometimes you read things, and it just appears strange, and you don't stop and formulate a question. And that is, fellows, anybody? Let's say you were going to describe these four. And you wanted to tell me about the pig, you wanted to tell me about the camel. How would you describe it? Now, why is it necessary to say Kimale Geiroho, Ufar? Why do you have to mention the positive? What does that have to do? Just mention the negative. If you're going to tell me that now, of those categories, which are Mafras Parasa or Shosara Sesa, and you can't eat. So just say, in each case, this one, because it's lacking. Tell me what it's lacking. What do I need to know? Obviously, if it's lacking split of, so I know it's Kimale Geiroho. Here it mentions it, as if the fact that it's Mali Gera is part of the problem. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right. So it's a strange way of expressing it. So those are the two questions that we're going to try and deal with. Okay? To summarize, these two questions are, first of all, it seems the whole parsha seems to be a bit redundant. Well, it's unnecessary. Because we have the general idea. If you have to have the two, you want them. So I mentioned these particulars. And secondly, in the manner of mentioning them, it seems strange because it's sort of stating the positive, as though the presence of the positive is one of the elements which makes it bad, makes it worse, so to speak. Okay? Now, with regard to the first question, there's a very fascinating Ramban. Ramban takes that up. Let's take a look. If you fellows have the Ramban,
yeah,
this is a very, very important point in its own right. I mean, it's significant to study in its own right. You should all be familiar with this Ramban. The Ramban is on Gimel. Toma presses parzof, v'shosah shesa prasos malas gera. So the Ramban says, Toma kosev azeh. The meaning of this pasuk is shakol behemah. That any animal which has both of these simanim, toklu, you may eat. Of a low toklu, be echemayam, but you shouldn't eat from one of them. So the Ramban is substantiating a point. That's the style of the Torah. When the Torah tells you these two, it means these two, and you have to use your head. You can deduce that. If it only has one of them, it's no good. So Yeroi Sheyomer came to their klal. It would have been fitting, it would have been correct, to make the point in a general way. But it specified these three that do chew the cud. V'chazer b'parsof, and the chazer with splitting of the hooves, but doesn't chew the cud. Because there are no others in the world which have that one simon and not the other. That's his point. So let's explain. What's the idea? He's telling us now why the Torah saw fit to specify these. Because he's saying that this encompasses the entire category and there are no others in existence that you'll find, that is to say, you will find, generally it would seem that the either an animal has none of this among them, or it has both. But for an animal to have one and not the other, there are, it's unusual, but there are exceptions. And it turns out in all of creation there are three that chew the cud and don't have split hooves, and in the other category that actually have split hooves and do not chew the cud, you only have one, that's the chazer. That's his answer. Now what is it, what's the point? Again, we could say, so what? I mean, what practical difference does that make to me? Since I can't eat them anyway. It would seem there is, I guess there is some practical difference, fellas. There is a, are you listening?
Yeah.
There is a practical difference, but I don't think it's significant in terms of including it in the Torah. That is to say, if you encounter an animal that has split hooves, and it's not a chazir, so you can automatically assume that it chews the cud.
Right.
I know, but that's not what the Torah is telling you. It's convenience. Obviously there's an afkamina that makes life easier in a certain sense. Or if you know that an animal chews the cud, you can assume it has split hooves if it's not one of these three. But that's not why the Torah told it to us. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Because the Torah is not listing all the animals that have split hooves. You see, that's not the point of the Torah, to make a list of all the animals that have both simanim. Nor is it making a list of all the animals that don't. Because there's no point. It's pointless. It just tells you the basic idea. That's the question. It's giving you the criteria, and that's sufficient. So over here, we don't really need this enumeration, because we can deduce that one siman is not good. So the Ramban is saying, yeah, but it turns out that these four are the only ones. Okay. So let's, so what do we learn from that? Rework that that event which is described in the Torah actually took place, and that's the real foundation. But that doesn't mean to say that there are no, that the Torah at certain points contains certain types of information which would indicate clearly to an intelligent individual that the author of the Torah, so to speak, could not have been an ordinary mortal, but that the source of the Torah has to be something which has complete knowledge of this, of the situation in reality. For example, if you're going to argue that the Torah does not come from God, so then the only other alternative is that it was written by people. Now then you're going to have to deal with the question, how is it possible at this particular point in time, when everybody acknowledges the Torah came into being, we're talking about a few thousand years ago, and the amount of knowledge that anybody had was limited. And certainly no one had explored the complete world. And you didn't have that kind of communication. That is to say, it would have been impossible for anybody to make a complete study of all of the different species in existence. So therefore, to come out with a statement, how is it possible that somebody would know that the only animal, for example, that has split hooves and does not chew the cud, is the chazik. That's the only one. Now, that type of knowledge didn't exist at that time. If you're going to say that it was written by individuals, and let's say they just decided that's all they had seen. You'll say, well, that's all they had seen. That's all they had observed. Yeah, but if they were, it's clear that whoever wrote the book, okay, I'm just using their terminology. Whoever wrote the book, clearly wanted this book to be accepted as divine, that's for sure. You have to argue. If you're going to, like, for example, one of the arguments I have about against conservative and reform that deny that it's divine, the divine origin of the Torah, but nevertheless, they praise it, they extol it, and they want they want to have it both ways, obviously, because they realize you can't present yourself as a religious leader to the Jews and just negate Torah completely. So on the one hand, they don't want to accept Torah. They're in a state of conflict.
That's why they accept it to begin with. They don't think it's divine.
So yeah, exactly. That's a very good question. So therefore, they have to resort to rationalizations, which are basically an attempt to satisfy certain emotional positions. That is to say, they want to be in a position of religious leadership of the Jews. So therefore, they say, well, no, it's very valuable because it has tremendous inspiration, and many of the ideas are very good, and so on and so forth. It's really a contradictory position.
Right.
Because today, if it's not divine, to then discard it. If you find one thing that makes sense, take it and then go on. So why are you keeping the Torah in your ark, and why you're presenting it as though it's to be revered, as though it's holy, and all of that? You want to milk it for all the symbolic value that it has. I mean, that's fiction terms. They're not being consistent.
You should look at every religion and take good ideas.
The matter is, as people have pointed out before me, is that to the contrary, if you maintain that it's not divine, then you should really get rid of the book. Because it's a complete lie. Whoever wrote it is a liar. And then trying to deceive people, because whoever wrote it then is saying that God spoke to him. And that all these things, it's Moshe Rabbeinu. If you're going to say it's Moshe Rabbeinu, you're going to say that he's the most deceptive individual. He's a complete liar. He's saying that God told them to command people and to threaten them, that if they don't do it, they're going to get killed, and so on and so forth. What credence, if somebody were to do that today, would come forth with a whole system of observances? And many of these things, by the way, like are things that appeal to people on a logical level. The Torah prescribes a death penalty for any other thing. If that's the case, then why would you revere a book like this and hold it up as a model to look up to when whoever wrote it was obviously a big liar? I didn't think that question.
And why don't they just look at every religion and take all the good ideas?
I'm sorry?
Just why don't they look at every religion and try to take good ideas out of all of them?
That's another good question. You're right. That's a good question. Why be Jewish? Why... It's divisive.
Leave our book alone.
If it was written by people, you're right, 100%. The logic of that position would lead to some kind of an interfaith phenomenon. That's why a lot of these reform guys are into that interfaith.
Uh-huh.
And they basically said the same thing, that all these, unless the faith is like today, like with Islam, where they believe in blowing up buildings, it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard for them to give value to that. But if the religion is essentially peaceful, and pretty much believes in the, compassion and goodness and all that in a very general way, you're right. I don't know how they would answer these questions, but I don't really think they are concerned about logical consistency. The point would be then, if you're going to assume that it was written by a person, then whoever wrote it, his objective was to convince people that it was divine. That's for sure. Now, you can't deny that, because it wasn't written like an ordinary book. It was written from the standpoint that this has been commanded by God.
Yeah, well, the book itself says it is given by God.
Everything. I mean, Moshe doesn't say it's his ideas. Moshe says this is what God commanded me to do. But to the contrary, Moshe didn't want to be a leader in the book. He presents himself as being very humble. Of course, according to them, we don't know if Moshe really was humble, because if they maintained that it was written by people. But would it make sense for an author at that time who wants this book to be sustained, retained throughout history? He wants to maintain this myth, so to speak. Now, people have been successful at doing that. People have been successful at convincing followers that that they received the prophecy. I mean, at this land, all the other religions are based upon deception. Every religion is based upon deception, because it's based upon the premise that certain individual was selected by God for a particular communication, and it's false. It's all false. It never happened. So it's total deception. Except for the Torah. The Torah is the only case where it's real. This is revelation. However, if you deny that, then you have to say that whoever composed the Torah and presented the Torah had an agenda. And the agenda was to convince people that this book was divine. Now, why would the person lend himself open to easy refutation? Why would anybody, if that's the case, you're putting yourself back in time. Now, we're not going to assume that this individual had access to all of the species in existence. That's something, I mean, maybe perhaps today, it's possible today. I don't know at what point in history it was possible to say that we know all of the different species. I'm not sure if they're still discovering species. I'm not sure about that. Or whether the science is so complete, because now we have access to all different parts of the world. And you have tremendous, all this, you know, ability to communicate with everybody throughout the world. So therefore, it's possible at a certain point in time to be convinced that we know. Like today, if we were to, if the book were to be written today, and we were going to include those species of animals that had one characteristic and not the other, and we were actually going to list it, and we're going to take a stand on that, if it turns out that another one is discovered, so then this book has been refuted. Bear in mind the consequences. You're taking a tremendous risk. And you see the way people operate, even politicians and leaders, and let's say financial analysts that's successful. Whenever they're going into a realm, when they're laying their reputation on the line, they're not going to predict outright that this stock is going to, you know, go up by 10%, or this one is going to go down, and so on and so forth, unless that's insider information, you know. But they're all extremely careful, and they tell you this is our projection, and past performance doesn't indicate what's going to happen in the future, and so on and so forth, simply because, A, they do not have any absolute knowledge of the future. They don't have it. And they know that if they expose themselves, if they put themselves in a position where they could be refuted, then they're finished. That's stupidity. All these astrologers and all these mystics and people today that predict the future, if you study them carefully, you'll see that they always do it in a very vague kind of a way so that it's immune to reputation. They're never going to go on the line. And just like all of these cases, you know, even with regard to different rebbes and miracles and predictions, you know, people claim that he predicted the future, he predicted this event. If you study it carefully, you'll see that nobody is making any kind of prediction in a very specific kind of a manner which lends itself to easy reputation. You know, the stories about, even the stories about the Lubavitch Rebbe, and I'm not attributing it to him. I'm not saying that he was involved in this, but there are many Hasidim that said that he has prophecy. Because he predicted this or he predicted that. It's all very general. Like about the... I don't even know whether it's authenticated. But the fact that the Jews shouldn't leave Israel during the Persian Gulf War, that they wouldn't get hurt. All these things are very general kinds of things. And to make specific predictions that can easily be refuted. For example, before, you know, like at this point in time, predict who the candidates will be in the next presidential election and what the outcome of the election will be and how many to the split hooves, an animal that has split hooves, the connection between that and Mali Gair is even greater because you just have one exception. Yeah, but there you're taking an enormous, an even bigger risk because how can you believe that you've exploited the category? That you've completely exhausted the category of those which could be exceptions to the rule. You found, now you may do a study and you'll find wherever you find split hooves, you always find shoe the cut. Then you find the chazir. And the chazir has split hooves but doesn't shoe the cut. So then what are you going to say? Are you going to commit yourself to the position that this is the only one? Again, you've seen there's no absolute relationship between the two. You see, there are two questions over here. That is, one is when you find chew the cud, does that automatically mean split hooves? Well, generally speaking, yes. But you found three exceptions. So if you found three exceptions, why should a logical person assume that these are the only three? There could be more. And the same is true with regard to the split hooves. Now, when you find split hooves, you find it pretty much, it always goes together with chew the cud. But then you found the chazir. That's the only exception you found. Now you see that there's no absolute connection between the two. That it's possible to have split hooves and not chew the cud. You found that in the chazir. So a rational individual, a logical person, would not assume that this is the only case. Now, why would he commit his entire credibility of his claim? Why would he base it and subject himself? And he doesn't have to. He does not, the Torah, that's the question of the Ramban, but does not have to mention this. There's no need now to make this commitment. And therefore, the only possible point in time was absolutely convinced that there's no other case. And for the thousands of years, and people will search the world, anybody knew that that's going to happen, any intelligent person knows, that with time, with progress, there's going to be progress, there's going to be time. The Torah don't speak about the Achras Hayavim. The Torah is always talking about what's going to happen in the future, that they will be dispersed, you'll be regathered, and so forth. So it stands to reason that discoveries will be made. So why would you take a risk like that blindly? You're going in blindly because there's complete areas of the world. Unless a person wants to make an absurd contention that at that point in time they had the same knowledge that we have today, which is the mind rules that out. Therefore, it leads you to only one conclusion, that the author of the Torah had complete knowledge of everything that exists in the creation and was absolutely confident of making this statement at a point in time when it could not have been established through ordinary scientific zoological exploration. So that's an amazing point. It's an amazing point, which, you see, this is not the foundation. So if you're gonna use this, practically speaking, tell a person that you got to believe the Torah is true because of this point. Now, a rational person would definitely stop in his tracks. You have to think about it. Now, I don't think it's going to work for most people. I think it's the kind of a point which is a support after the fact. It's an indicator. It's an indicator. See, I don't know that it has that kind of an impact on a person who doesn't really have any knowledge of Torah. He finds it curious and interesting, but I just, for whatever reason, it's not sufficient. And it cannot replace the classical basis, you know, the foundation of Torah Sinai. Even that, I don't think that the first order of business, in terms of trying to win a, you have to get the person involved, and you have to show the person that the Torah is different than any other ordinary religion. That beneath the surface, there's a system of tremendous chachma. And that the Torah is rational, and it's a way of life, and in every area you see the tremendous depth of the Torah. And then, when a person has basically changed his attitude and has an attitude of respect for the Torah on that basis, so then they'll start to ask. I think that's the way to go. Well, I mean, are we supposed to believe it just because of the chachma, or is there any kind of a foundation in, from which we can draw the conclusion that the Torah was given by God? So then you go into Torah Sinai. But Torah Sinai is really a proof. This, I would say, I wouldn't categorize it as a proof. I would categorize it as a very powerful indication. Because there are certain, you see, not everything is an absolute truth. But you'll see that. A lot of times you'll have an idea. And when you defend the idea, you'll have to give the exposition and what the foundation of the idea is, and, you know, why you believe the idea is true. But then you'll encounter certain things, and you'll say, yeah, that really fits in with it. And that lends tremendous support to the idea. That reinforces the idea. So I think that that's what the significance of the Ramban is. The Ramban just merely tells you, he raises the question as to why the Torah mentions these particular cases, and he gives the answer, and all he says is because these are the only ones. And of course the question is, so why? And that's what I'm trying to explain. That this point has tremendous significance, that a person has to take this to heart. And that, you know, that hardens his heart, so to speak. Think about it. Analyze it. This is a tremendous refutation of anyone that would say that Torah does not come from a supernatural source. It's based upon the fact, it's absurd to say that the zoological, so to speak, the information as to what in all the species in the world, in the universe, that anybody at that point in time would know of all the species. As I said, I'm not sure if we have that knowledge today. Anybody aware? Anybody in that field? Do we have knowledge of all the species? Can we say for sure that we've discovered all the species and we'll never discover any other species?
I'm pretty sure they're still finding new ones every day, like the rainforest.
I can't hear you guys.
In the rainforest?
Yes.
I think they're still finding, because
that definitely substantiates the point. If we're still in the process of discovering, and we may have to revise our understanding, so that even today, with the extensive amount of scientific knowledge and so forth, we don't have it. So, everybody knows that it's only in the last few centuries that we've made this enormous advances in terms of knowledge, and even today we don't have all the knowledge. So it's impossible to maintain that at the time of the Torah they had this kind of reach, they had this kind of knowledge and this type of communication. So, anybody very confidently put forth such a claim, which we didn't have to do, because it's not in an area. So sometimes you're in an area where you're making certain claims and you have no choice. You have to back it up. For example, as I said, if you're a financial analyst, if you're a political consultant, so that's your job. You claim you have knowledge of how the politics work out, so you have to make predictions. You have no choice. And then, if you're good and if you're lucky, maybe they'll come true. If not, you have to put yourself on the line. You can't say over here that the author had no choice but to put himself on the line. He somehow or other got lucky. That's absurd. Because there was no reason. To the contrary, the very inclusion of these categories is superfluous, according to the way the Torah works. The Torah doesn't include all the details. So therefore, there was no need to bring it up. And secondly, you're subjecting yourself to something which would easily be very easily refuted. Throughout the course of history, all we have to do is discover another animal which has split hooves and doesn't chew the cud. And then there you go. How come the Torah just mentioned the chazir? So you, for no reason at all, for no possible gain, you're subjecting yourself to something which can only be a problem. No human mind would operate that way. So therefore, one has to conclude that the author of the Torah had access to all of the knowledge of what exists in the universe. I think it's a very powerful point. What do you guys think? Okay, so I think I'm going to stop here. I really was going to go into... For next week, I'm going to take up the Kli Yekar. You don't have to read it, because once you read it, it's going to lose... The question that he deals with is, now that we've established... He doesn't make this point, and Ramban makes this point. I wanted to share this point with you. But the next question is, in actually describing those animals which have one and not the other, it mentions because it has the positive, but it doesn't have the negative. And that first part, because it has the positive, is superfluous. What it does is simply limit yourself to mentioning the negative.